Pseudopod number 1. August 11, 2006. Today's story, Bagman, by Scott Sigler.
Good evening, and welcome to Pseudopod, the bi-weekly horror podcast magazine. I'm your host, Mer Lafferty, co-editor of Pseudopod, along with Ben Phillips. We strive to bring you the best in horror audio. Like our sister podcast, Escape Pod, we are a paying market, supported by the donations of our listeners. Our story this week is Bagman by Scott Sigler. You may have heard Scott's name on Escape Pod, in association with the Parsec Awards as a two-time nominee, or whenever someone mentions a popular podcast novel. He's written three, Earthcore, Ancestor, and Infection, and has become the most popular podcast novelist to date. We thought it fitting that his story be the launching title for our podcast. The story is read to us by my co-editor, Ben Phillips. So pour yourself a glass of whiskey and lock your doors, because I've got a story for you, and I promise you it's true.
Bagman by Scott Sigler. Thursday, 8:57 p.m. The phone rang. I pulled myself away from a Seinfeld rerun, picked myself out of my lazy boy, and shuffled toward the cordless. I always put the cordless back in its little holder so when it rings I have to go get it anyway. Kinda defeats the purpose of having one, but hey, it was a gift. Hello?
May I please speak to Mr. Frank McMillian? A little boy's voice asked.
You're talking, Adam, I said. I didn't recognize the voice, at least not right off, and I wondered how the kid got the number. I also wondered if I'd have to change it again. I'd changed it 4 times in the past 3 months. The price of stardom, I suppose, and the price of writing newspaper articles that piss people off.
This is Frank McMillian? The voice asked.
Yes, kid, this is Frank McMillian. Who is this?
The pause was only slight. Good evening, Mr. McMillian, the kid's voice said. This is the Bagman.
My knees went instantly weak, and I felt like I'd been kicked dead square in the nuts. My head swam. I needed a deep breath, but couldn't draw one. I shuffled for the lazy boy, grateful it was only 5 feet away. Cordless gadgets come in handy after all. This is some kind of sick fucking joke. I fell back into the chair, breathless and weak.
No, sir, the tiny voice said. No, sir, this is no joke. You've heard enough of the police tapes, Mr. McMillian. I think you recognize my voice by now.
No, I don't recognize it, I lied. Somewhere in my head it seemed that if I admitted recognition, then I was accepting this call as real, accepting my own doom. A part of me refused to recognize the voice's identity, but I knew damn well who it was. I don't know who the fuck this is, but you're not funny.
That may be the case, Mr. McMillian, but I assure you I am the Bagman. You're in denial now. It will pass. I'll be paying you a visit tomorrow at 3 p.m.
I'd heard such conversations before, but those were tapes. Tapes of other people. He was talking to me now, and that was a whole different story. I wondered how he could be so fucking polite. He sounded like he was drumming up candy sales for the local Little League team, not announcing my death warrant. You've made a mistake, I said. Claudette. I still couldn't breathe, and my words were more puffs of frightened air rather than an actual voice. Really, I think you've made a mistake.
That's not the case, Mr. McMillian. We both know that. I'll see you tomorrow. Tell the police the code is Tweety, Sylvester, Daffy. Can you remember that, sir?
Tweety, Sylvester, Daffy. My mortality spelled out in Looney Tunes characters. I had no doubt the cops would have the same code.
Goodbye, Mr. McMillian. Have a pleasant evening.
I heard a click, then a dial tone. The phone dropped from my hands to fall noiselessly on the shag carpeting. On the TV, Kramer burst through the door. The crowd roared in delight. I didn't think it was funny. Thursday, 10:02 p.m. I was on the phone again, this time with Shauna Perot, police commissioner. I remember when she earned that honor. Note the word earned. It wasn't handed to her because she was a woman in a man's world, like most bitches who get high-ranking jobs. Shauna was the real deal, not some affirmative action entitlement piece of shit getting a job over some hard-working stiff who made the poor career choice of being born a white male. "Did he give you a code?" Shauna asked. "Yes," I said. I didn't say any more. I didn't want to. I'd recognized the bagman's voice. I was almost 100% sure my ass was fried. "Well," Shauna said, "what was it?" I swallowed. I didn't want this to happen. I knew the game. Bagman always called the cops and gave them a code. He gave that same code to the victim. Even after 2 years of killings, the fucking cranks were still calling 911, claiming the bagman had called them and that they needed protection. His code solved that problem. He was a damn courteous kid. Thing was, the codes became more of a warning to the cops than a way to separate out the sick, attention-starved loonies. The cops wanted to confirm Bagman's targets, not so they could stop him, but so they could stay the hell out of his way. My mouth was dry. I wanted a drink.
I wanted 17 drinks, all stiff ones, but I hadn't decided if I wanted to spend my last 18 hours on Earth 3 sheets to the wind.
I closed my eyes. It was time to find out if this was for real. "Tweety, Sylvester, Daffy," I said. I waited, then opened my eyes. Shauna didn't say anything. I knew, once and for all, that I was a dead man. "I'm sorry, Frank," she said. I could hear despair in her voice. I couldn't blame her. 2 years of watching this circus freak kill people at will would be enough to exhaust any cop. "Yeah," I said. "Me too." "What did you do?" she asked. "Why is he coming after you?" "I don't know," I said. "Claudette Peters." "I know I've been a shit. You don't win 2 Pulitzers by being nice, but I haven't done anything to deserve this." In the back of my head, I wondered if there was something, some forgotten sin, some repressed memory, but I couldn't dredge anything up from my swampy mind. "Frank, you know the deal," Shauna said. "If you want police protection, I can't deny it, but I urge you to think that over strongly. You could be causing the death of good men." That was how bad it had become in the past 18 months. The cops wouldn't go near the bagman unless they were ordered. Even then, most of them just quit. Nobody blames them now. It's one thing to lay your life on the line in the name of duty. It's quite another to risk death knowing there's absolutely nothing you can do. Nobody wants to die, especially the way the bagman kills you. Death by massive brain hemorrhaging. No external wounds, no broken bones, no internal bleeding other than the head. Coroners said the victim's brains looked like they'd been cooked in a microwave. A real mess. I saw one of those brains. Microwave wasn't my choice of descriptive kitchen appliances. I preferred a blender set on puree. I saw a coroner open up a victim's skull with one of those spooky bone saws. Fucker's brain spilled out like a damn milkshake. I wasn't surprised to see most everyone lose their lunch. But the coroner puked too. The coroner. You know it's some sick-ass shit when the fucking coroner pukes. The first 4 or 5 victims had everyone stumped. City authorities had no idea what caused such bizarre deaths. The CDC sent a team down and everything. Then the calls for help started coming in. Word gets around on the street, and seeing as the bagman gave everyone 18 hours to live, people talked. It didn't take long for the story to spread. By the 20th victim, even die-hard gangsters were calling the cops for help. Sure, the strange killings made the news, but no one knew what we had on our hands. Not till Rocco Pizza Face Salvatore called the cops for protection. Told the DA he'd give up everything he had on the Caprizi family. Everything. The DA almost shit himself. All the cops had to do was keep him alive. The cops guarded Rocco like he was the president that night. Even squirreled him away to a safe house. The protection, the move, it didn't matter. The bagman showed up at the appointed hour and turned Salvatore's brain to oatmeal. 2 cops died that night. The bagman ignored their bullets, ignored them until they tried to tackle him. Then he touched those cops, and they died. "Frank," Shauna said, "did you hear me? Do you want police protection or not?" Her voice sounded shaky. If I asked, she had to send the cops. None of them would volunteer. Not anymore. 12 cops with pureed brains assured that. "No," I said. "Forget it, Shauna. No cops." She breathed a sigh of relief. Insensitive as hell, but I didn't hold it against her. "I'm authorized to give you a gun, Frank. Anything you want." I've seen you guys shoot a fucking bazooka at him, I said. It won't make a difference. The gun's not for the bagman, she said. It's for you. Now there was a little detail I'd missed in 2 years of covering this story. The cops were willing to give people guns. Suicide instead of facing the bagman. How's that for civil rights? My diehard reporter nature should have jumped on that story like a bum on a bologna sandwich, but that part of me was dead already. It died the minute the bagman said he was coming for me. Hard to care about the news when you won't be alive to see tomorrow's evening edition. No, I said. No gun. I hung up. Shauna didn't call back. Friday, 9:32 a.m. It's funny how much time I spent on the phone my last few hours. Ironic, really. People say the pen is mightier than the sword. Nah, that's bullshit. Words aren't a reporter's weapon. The phone is. Hours and hours and hours on the phone, calling contact after contact. Call one guy to follow up a lead, get a name, call another guy, get a name, call another guy, set up a meeting. At that meeting, what do you get? More names and numbers. Words ain't shit. Too many of my colleagues think their dainty little fingers type out brilliant prose that wows the reading audience. Bullshit. All people want is the story. Any schmuck can string together a few sentences around some nice, tasty facts. It's not like we're T.S. Eliot, although some of these conceited, arrogant bastards seem to think they are. There's only one talent in the reporting field, and that's getting the story. After a lifetime on the phone, I guess I couldn't quit. I called my ex-wife at work the next morning. Hadn't talked to her in 4 months. She was pissed because she divorced me back when I was making reporter wages, peanuts. Now I had 2 Pulitzers under my belt and a bona fide New York Times #1 bestseller about the bagman's childhood. I had money falling out of my ass. The greatest joy that money gave me? That Sheila didn't get any of it.
Pratchett Enterprises, Sheila McMillian speaking. She'd kept her married name. Never could figure that one out. Hi, Toots. She'd loved being called Toots when we were married, at least until she found out that's what I called all the women I was fucking at the time. She kind of hated it after that. Hello, Frank. Her voice held that odd mix of ice and familiar warmth only an ex-wife can master. I haven't talked to you in months. How's life in the fast lane? Great. I wanted to get this over with fast. It wasn't like I had much time. Listen, Sheila, there's something I want to tell you. Oh, sounds serious, Frank, she said. You never were too good at serious. I know. Listen, Sheila, I wanted to say that when we were together, I really loved you. I've never loved anyone but you. I screwed up things for us both, and I wanted to tell you that I was wrong. And I'm sorry. She was silent for a moment. Then her voice came, shaky and weak. Frank, I don't know what to say. The coldness in her voice was gone. Now there was only shock. I knew why. We'd known each other for 20 years, spent 6 of them married, and I don't think she ever once heard me say I'm sorry to anyone about anything. She started to say something else, but I hung up. I sat back in the Lazy Boy and clicked on the TV. Rerun a Knight Rider. The phone rang. I knew it was Sheila. I didn't answer. Friday, 11:34 a.m. 7-year-old Tommy Archer, from the South Side, died in a drive-by. The kid never did anything to anyone. Just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that could be anywhere, any time of the day in this fucked-up city. Stray 12-gauge blew his head clean off. I saw the pictures. Hell, I was the one who broke the story. That was Pulitzer #1. In the first months of the bagman's reign, he was the biggest story on the planet. Everyone was trying to figure out why bullets didn't stop him, why he didn't burn when they turned a flamethrower on him, how he could get into any building, any prison, any fortress at the appointed time, things like that. He was so inhuman with these weird powers that no one stopped to see him as a little boy. No one except me. He always looked blurry on film or on TV, never clear. But if you saw him in person, and I had 37 times in the past year alone, you could recognize his face. I've seen him more than anyone outside of the police department. What can I say? I'm an old guard senior reporter who used to go out drinking Manhattans with the chief of police. Membership has its privileges. It took me 4 weeks of looking through archived articles of every story concerning young white boys. 4 weeks, 12 hours a day, staring at newspaper clippings. Didn't write a single story in that time. Almost got fired. It was worth it. Worth it is spelled P-U-L-I-T-Z-E-R, by the way. I broke that story. Tommy Archer, 7-year-old victim of urban violence, back from the dead to kill sinners. Friday, 12:02 p.m. No one complained anymore, not even the liberals. Police did everything possible, tried every weapon, even brought in psychics and parapsychologists, if you can believe that. Those schmucks couldn't do anything either. Sick fucking world we live in, full of sick people. The bagman became my only beat. I covered him day in and day out. I wasn't the only one. Every major metro has a reporter in this city, including a dozen European papers and rags as far away as Japan and South Africa. Everyone loves watching American scumbags bite the bullet. I have to admit, I kind of liked it too. At least until the call. So there's around 50 print and broadcast reporters who do nothing but cover the bagman. His day-to-day killings don't make much of a media splash anymore. Don't do much but cause grief and humiliation for the victim's family as reporters scramble to find out what the poor bastard did wrong. You never know when he's going to off a celebrity, and that's news. Guess I'm a celebrity now. I'll be good for a few headlines myself. Yeah, about 50 people covering the bagman, but I've got an advantage. I lived here before little Tommy got rolling. That's how I won my second Pulitzer. Got a tip from Shauna Perot that Hasbro, the toy company, was filing all these Freedom of Information Act requests with the police department, trying to get a clear picture of Tommy's face. Took me 3 weeks to get the story, but I got it. They wanted to make dolls. Dolls. Can you believe that? The supernatural freaky dead boy is turning people's brains into porridge, and Hasbro wants to turn him into a Cabbage Patch Kid or something. I cracked the story wide open. It drew gobs of national attention. Hasbro quickly forgot about the plan. Didn't matter. Sweatshops made the dolls anyway, and they sold like hotcakes. Bagman shirts, hats, greeting cards with the clever slogan, "Don't answer the phone." People were making a killing off Tommy. Pardon the pun. Like I said, a sick fucking world. Friday, 12:37 p.m. I tried to reach my daughter at her college. Hadn't talked to her in weeks. We're not very close. She's living with this black guy. Not that I care, mind you, but it's still unsettling even if you're not a racist. She's in college, you know? You worry about rapists. You wonder if this black guy is a good man or if he's ghetto trash getting a free ride to college because of the color of his skin. You wonder if he's going to take her whether she wants it or not. Got her answering machine. I left a regular message, told her I loved her. She'd find out the rest soon enough. Friday, 2:54 p.m. The doorbell rang. Can you believe that? He rang the doorbell. Little fucker could get into any building, anytime, anywhere, and at my house, he rang the doorbell. I wasn't getting up to let him in, though. Fuck him, he was there to kill me, after all. There was no point in playing games, no point in running or hiding. When your time was up, the bag man found you. No one knew how, he just did. Some ran, some hid, some fought. They all died. Me, I preferred not to waste my last few minutes in some useless dash for freedom, for survival. I'd covered this story for 2 years. I'd seen the shit people had pulled to stay away from the bagman. None of it ever worked. I remember the best one of all, the incident that really let us know there was no way to stop Tommy Archer. Vincent Emil was a rich bastard, a Croatian immigrant who made a killing in real estate deals, owned the Quickie Burger restaurant chain, even owned a minor league baseball team in Kansas, of all places. Pompous bastard, I can tell you that for free. Wore a lot of jewelry, Italian silk suits, that kind of thing. He got the call just over a year ago. Did he panic? Not Emil, no way. Called his private jet, had the pilot fuel it up, then he called me. Said he was going to be the first to outrun the bagman, that he'd be at 10,000 feet at the appointed hour. He invited me along, wanted the world to know that Vincent Emil wasn't going to be bagged by anyone. Craziest shit I ever saw. We were at 9,500 feet. Emil was laughing his head off, drunk on life, elated that he'd escaped certain death. Then the bathroom door opened. Tommy came out. Didn't say a word, walked right up to Emil and touched his head. Emil dropped dead on the spot. Tommy walked back to the bathroom and shut the door. It was only then that I realized I'd shit myself. No one went near that bathroom. We landed 25 minutes later. A cop finally opened the bathroom door. Tommy was gone, of course. He'd somehow boarded a plane. While it flew at 9,500 feet, did his thing, then disembarked. Crazy shit. Crazy kid. No way to outrun him. No way at all. So I sat there in my lazy boy, waiting in as much comfort as I could muster. My house, my things. No running for this old reporter.
I had, however, decided to have those drinks. All 17 of them. The bagman was here for me, and I was good and smashed. "It's open, Tommy, old boy." The handle turned, the door opened, and there he was, smiling politely with his perpetually missing left incisor. I wonder if he'd cashed in with the Tooth Fairy before his head absorbed that rogue slug. He shut the door behind himself, rubbed his feet on the throw rug in front of the door, and came in. There was a rosy glow on his cheeks. His straight blonde hair was caught somewhere between combed and wild. It's a look only little boys can carry well, because they don't try, it just happens. I wondered if that's what his hair had looked like before the slug ripped through his head like a Ginsu through a tomato. No trace of the wound, by the way, just a normal little boy head. I'd drunk a bottle of Southern Comfort to blur things. It hadn't worked. Somehow I was suddenly sober despite the liquor. I'm sure that was his doing. I'd meant to ask him why he called himself the Bagman. Some last act, huh? No one knew. We assumed it was because he bagged people, as in body bag. Like I said, I meant to ask him, but when he walked through my door, it just didn't seem to matter.
"Hello, Mr. McMillian," the bagman said.
"Hiya, Tommy." I wanted to run, but that wouldn't do any good. It was 3:03. I'd watched this scene many times as an impartial observer. No one got away from Tommy Archer, the bagman. I offered the bottle to him. "Care for a swig?"
"No thanks, Mr. McMillian,"
Tommy said. He just stared at me. He had the face, hair, body, and gap-toothed smile of an innocent 7-year-old, but his eyes were something else. They seemed very old. Older than me.
"Tommy, are you sure there hasn't been some mistake?" There was a whine in my voice I hadn't heard since Sheila walked out on me. I'd promised myself I wasn't going to beg, that I would die like a man. So much for promises. I was never that good at them anyway.
"You're a liar, Mr. McMillian," Tommy said. "You've hurt a lot of people in your job. Printed stories you knew weren't true just because they were sensational. You've made quite a name covering me, but before you won that first Pulitzer, you were not a very nice reporter, sir."
"There's no such thing as a nice reporter. The only nice people write that useless social page shit, those feature puff pieces. I'm a hard news man, Tommy."
I whipped the bottle at him. It went right through and smashed into the wall on the far side. Shards of glass sparkled in the flickering light of the television. Uzis don't work on him, but I could hurt him with a half-empty fifth of liquor. Right. "Come on, Tommy," I said. I felt tears coming down my cheeks. If my ass hadn't been socked into the Lazy Boy, I'm sure I would have been on my knees. "I was a scumbag reporter for years, sure, but that's not any reason to kill a man."
"No, it's not," Tommy said. "That's not why I'm here. You remember Claudette Peters, don't you, Mr. McMillian?"
My blood temperature dropped to 0 in a fraction of a second. From the moment I'd heard his voice the night before, I'd known why he was coming for me. I'd known, I just hadn't allowed myself to remember. I blocked the memory, just as I'd blocked it for the last 32 years, but as soon as he spoke her name, I couldn't stop the flood of memory. "Tommy," I said pleadingly. "Tommy, that was 32 years ago. I was a drunk kid, for God's sake."
"I don't care if you were drunk or sober, sir," Tommy said in a deadpan. "You raped her."
I broke. The tears came uncontrollable. I'd raped her. She wanted it, flaunted it, then played games with me. I hit her. Only once, but it was enough. Took the fight right out of her. In a drunken stupor, I'd taken her virginity by force. I almost told Tommy it was just a date rape, but I didn't bother. The mere fact that he was here in my living room meant I was dead. There was no bargaining with the bagman.
"She killed herself last week, Mr. McMillian," Tommy said. "She never married, never had kids. From the night you raped her, she could never trust anyone. Counseling didn't help, nothing did. It's unusual for such an event to cause such a high degree of trauma, Mr. McMillian, but it destroyed her life, and you're to blame."
"I was 19 years old," I said, crying like a little girl. "It was a frat party. I was drunk."
"This is true, Mr. McMillian, but it's still a sin, and you've got to pay for it."
"There's no one else out there to kill," I said. "No one worse than me."
"They're all gone, Mr. McMillian," Tommy said. You were one of the people that cheered me on while I cleansed the city of that scum. I read your editorials in the beginning about how someone had to get rid of these criminals anyway. Good people like yourself loved me until all the really bad people were gone and I moved on to the only a little bit bad people. No one liked that. You knew some of those people. They weren't gangbangers or assassins. They were neighbors, friends, co-workers. But they were also pedophiles, child abusers, spouse abusers, con men. They were also rapists, like you. And now it's your turn. It's 3 p.m., Mr. McMillian.
He stepped towards me. I shut my eyes. I didn't want to see it coming. I heard his hands vibrating, thickly, like a dozen bumblebees trapped in chocolate pudding. I felt a tingle on my forehead. His hands came from my head, but I didn't think about myself. All I could focus on was Claudette Peters and those tears of fear and pain and betrayal that streaked her face 32 years before. I remembered her now, every last detail.
The entire staff of Pseudopod will be at DragonCon in Atlanta, Georgia, this Labor Day weekend, so please come by and say hi. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated, and is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license. Our theme music is provided by Anders Manga. We are supported solely by the donations of you, the listener, so that we can pay our authors. We have a PayPal button at pseudopod.org. Next week, we bring you a story by Richard Dansky about a young man who's just seeking some good advice. Until then, lock your doors and let voicemail get the phone call from that eerie force that is determined to destroy you.